From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
Gibbet Lane by Anthony Gittens. They walked together down the road with a purposeful but labored stride, which, in addition to their farcically large and elaborate rucksacks, every pastime has its panache, marked them as town dwellers on a weekend hike. Their movements and pace, schooled to a pavement scuttle, lacked rhythm. They fatigued themselves much more by swinging fast downhill than by plodding uphill, and their long periods of silence were due to this fatigue, and not to any absorption or even interest in the scenery. Conclusive proof that they came from the noisome intestines of a large town was afforded by their pale faces and a complete ignorance of the purpose of gate fasteners. And as they were in Surrey, where the country timidly begins south of the latitude through Guildford, and as they expected any and every farmhouse to supply them with a tea, were quite willing to pay, and as they behaved with a transatlantic disregard for other people's property, it was evident that they were Londoners. The taller one, who had a wart described by his mother as a birthmark and by his father as a damn pimple on his forehead and sheepish eyes, was a Mr. Golan, aged 32, and he worked in the Chancery Lane office of the Belladonna Insurance Company. His friend Mr. Pounceby, aged 37, had a large hat and rather short hair, and also worked in the Chancery Lane office of the Belladonna Insurance Company. They both had the unimpressionable and skeptical nature common to all insurance agents, and also that deficiency of imagination which is normal in businessmen. In fine, they were stolid creatures, material in outlook, daring jesters at the expense of the League of Nations, damned old mother's meeting, Mr. Pounceby would say, no less daring in their censure of politicians, start every war they do, Mr. Golan would observe, and raucously contemptuous of the supernatural. Ghosts? All bosh and eyewash, they would chorus disdainfully. It is particularly important to remember that they were so scornful about psychic phenomena. Had they been windy old men, or neurotics, or journalists, no genuine authority could have attached to the story of theirs. They had just for the fourth time unsuccessfully requested tea at a farmhouse. Frightfully unsociable people round here, remarked Mr. Pounceby, as they trudged on, their huge limp rucksacks, likening them to parched camels searching for an oasis. Yes, frightfully, agreed Mr. Colin. Dash it all, you'd think they'd be jolly glad to make a tanner out of 2 cups of tea. Or 2 cups of tea out of tanner, I mean tannin, rejoined Mr. Pounceby wittily. I wish I could think of things like that as quickly as you do, George, said Mr. Golan with intense admiration. You know, you ought to write a play. I'll bet you could do that. No all-coward sort of dialogue as easy as pat. Oh, I don't know, said the gratified Mr. Pounceby, desperately cranking his mind in the hope of churning out another witticism. But it was like winding an empty sausage machine. Nothing emerged. He did try a pun on coward and pat, but even in his own eyes it was a dismal failure, so he hastily revived the original topic. No, they're not so hospitable as people in town, he declared, just as if he were in the habit of dropping into houses in, say, the Cromwell Road and offering the residents 3 pence for a cup of tea. Hello, there's someone ahead, up by that signpost. We'll ask him where the nearest pub is. They covered the intervening distance in silence. The man, who stood near the old, discolored signpost, occasionally swiping with his stick at the long grass, had a pale oval face with bright eyes set in dark pits, and a thin curved nose which came forth like an unexpected challenge from his meek and otherwise regular features. He was about 50, and wore a brown tweed shooting hat, back to front with a small feather on one side, very old breeches and dull green stockings, a soiled white cotton scarf tied around his neck, and tucked into his faded yellow corduroy waistcoat and a comparatively new heather mixture Norfolk jacket. The clothes did not hang well on him. It was as if at one time and another he had been given each garment by a different employer, for they were oddly contrasted and all of better material than probably he himself could afford. Altogether, with his rough apparel and sensitive features, he cut an unusual figure. He might have been a poet forced to earn his living on the land, and would indeed have been less conspicuous at the Café Royal than he was here. Mr. Pounceby, however, was not of this opinion. "Typical countryman," he remarked as they approached. "Yes," agreed Mr. Golan, wishing that he had been the first to make this astute observation. "Shall I ask him, or will you?" Mr. Pounceby said he would. He straightened his back and tried to look as if they had walked 30 miles that day and was enjoying it, whereas he had only walked 7 and was loathing it. "Which is the way to the nearest public house?" he called out. The man stopped swiping at the grass with his stick and looked at them. Before replying, he deftly decapitated a small clump of rushes. "There's one at Felday," he said. "Which way's that?" "Oh, I see it's on the signpost," said Mr. Pounceby. "If you go by that signpost," rejoined the man, "it'll be the English Channel you'll reach before Felday. It swings round with the wind. See?" He grasped it with one hand and hoisted it. "Now it's right." "Thanks," said Mr. Golan. "Not that'll help you any better, even now, to find Felday," said the man, "if you're strange to these parts." He began chewing a reed. "I see you are," he added. This huffed Mr. Pounceby, who, though proud of being a townie, always hoped to pass unidentified as such in the country, because, as he candidly confessed, "they'll do much more for you, you know, if they think you're one of their sort." Unfortunately, he always failed to pass as one of their sort, because he believed that, to do in Rome as the Romans do, it was only necessary to wear a toga and sandals. "Isn't it rather a waste of the taxpayers' money," he said, "to put up signposts which are of no use?" "Squire's orders, nothing to do with the taxpayers," replied the man. "Very few people use this lane anyway." And in his tone there was something which implied that the lane was rarely frequented, not because it was out of the way, but because it had an unpleasant history. He threw away the reed he had been chewing, and moved the post again until it was upright. Then he noted the shadow which it cast. The sun was disappearing behind the muddle of dark clouds, and the dim attenuated shadow struck the base of an oak in the opposite hedge. 10 minutes to 5, he observed. "You've got 1.5 miles to go." "Well, thanks," said Mr. Golan again, for he was no conversationalist at the best of times, and having noticed the lowering sky, he was anxious to reach shelter before it rained. He shook hands with the man and moved towards the lane, which was little more than a path leading to Felday. Mr. Pounceby also awarded the stranger a handshake, and at the same time was about to express his thanks when, Mr. Pounceby afterwards remained positive on this point, the man said, "I'll come some of the way with you." "Well, thanks very much," said Mr. Pounceby, and caught up with his friend Golan, while the man fell into step on the outside of Mr. Pounceby. "There's a use for everything, you see," said the man. Golan and Pounceby, appalled by the prospect of another 1.5 miles, had abruptly subsided into one of their periodic silences. "Take that signpost. As a signpost, it's useless. It should say how far it is to Felday. It should say that this lane's called Gibbet Lane. It should quite reasonably always point in the same direction. It doesn't do any of these things. But all the same, it's a pretty good sort of sundial." He spoke swiftly, smoothly, giving scant opportunity for questions or comment. "When poor old J.C. had such a terrible fright up here, over 1 year ago that was, I thought it was that signpost that did it. Until I got home, I did, anyway. J.C.'s my dog, a red setter. Does look a bit queer in this dull light, don't you think?" Mr. Pounceby glanced back over his shoulder. "Come on," growled Mr. Golan, who was concerned about the rapidly darkening sky. "Like a gallows, rather," added the man without waiting for a reply. "Actually, there was a gallows there once. The last man they hanged on it was a farmer named Coulter, James Coulter. Case of wife murder. 2 hours after he was dead, they found he was innocent. The next morning, the gibbet was down. Struck by lightning, some said. But there were 6 people in the neighborhood who swore they'd seen James Coulter during the night." He paused for a moment. Low in the sky, the last pale strand of the sun disappeared, and a small unexpected wind murmured a requiem in the trees. Then there was silence. The man's voice became more subdued. "That's why this lane is called Gibbet Lane. And whatever people may say, there's something mighty queer about it. I never bring Jacy up here now, but I often wonder what he could tell about the afternoon he took fright up here. It was like this. We were walking together down this lane. Jacy was 2 or 3 yards in front of me. Mind you, he isn't a nervous dog, and never has been, but he suddenly stopped dead and looked around. His eyes were focused about where I was, but he didn't seem to see me. God only knows what did catch his eye, for I've never seen such fear in the look of beast or man as I did then. The hair on his back went straight up, and he began edging away as if to hell and all the devils were there. I clicked my finger 2 or 3 times and called out quietly, but it didn't have any effect. Then he let out a yell and bolted. My God, how he bolted! He went slap down this lane faster than the greyhound could have done, I reckon, and howling all the way. The man nodded ahead to where the gable of a farmhouse was visible. The window under the gable faced up the lane, which was dead straight and for the most part hemmed in by high rocky banks, as if it had once been the bed of a stream. There was no grass, no plant life, no vegetation at all on either bank. It was a somber gully, and shadows were now huddling into the crannies and fissures of its barren sides. That's where I used to live, with my sister. It's empty now. My sister died last March. Well, JC was back there in a flash and had jumped the gate into the yard before my sister had time to run downstairs and open it for him. You see, she not only heard him coming, but had been looking out of her bedroom window. That's the one you can see from here. When he started behaving so queerly, she'd seen it all. A couple of minutes later, I got back, wondering whether that queer-looking signpost had had anything to do with it, or whether the dog had seen something strange. It's said they're more susceptible than human beings to, well, to anything psychic. They can sense the presence of death, too. Anyway, I asked my sister what her opinion was. She said, "Oh, he must have taken fright at some noise, if you've been with him at the moment." "But I was with him," I said, "just behind him." "With him? When he bolted?" "Yes. In fact, I was with him all the way down until he ran off like that." My sister looked at me rather curiously and asked if I'd been drinking. She knew very well, though, that I never do drink, and I told her so. She fixed her eyes very queerly on me then. "I saw you come some other way down," she said. "Then I attended to something in the room. When I looked out again, I..." "Dick, I'm frightened," she said suddenly and caught hold of my arm. "You're telling me the truth, aren't you? Swear to me you were in the lane when..." "Nancy," I said, "I give you my oath that I was with the dog every step of the way till he bolted from me. Why do you ask?" She went very white then, and I thought she was going to faint. "I don't understand it," she cried. "I can see every inch of that lane from my window, and as God's my witness, I swear there was not a soul in it when Jacy took fright. The dog was absolutely alone." You can imagine what a shock that gave me, continued the man after a moment's pause, for I remembered that the dog had been looking where I was, and yet, he said very slowly, "there was something about me, shall I say something in me, so horrible that it sent an animal half mad with fear. It's the sort of thing that can easily turn a man's reason, isn't it, if he thinks about it much?" At this point, the man stopped abruptly, and Mr. Pounceby, more perturbed than he cared to show, realized that the story was at an end. He realized also with genuine uneasiness that they were now walking down the very lane where this peculiar incident had taken place. At that moment, he wished he was miles from the spot. Subsequently, he wished most emphatically that he had never gone down the lane at all. It served him as a perennial topic of conversation, of course, but the whole of that afternoon's experience was one that he would never have voluntarily undergone again. "What a remarkable thing," he said, mastering his uneasiness. "What's remarkable?" asked Mr. Gawlin, speaking for the second time since leaving the signpost. They passed into gloomy shadows, formed by a dark conspiracy of elms and the failing afternoon light. Westward, the rain was already sheeting the skyline. "Why, the story this gentleman has just told us," retorted Mr. Pounceby. Mr. Gawlin looked about him with a perplexed frown and then stared very hard at his friend. "What the dickens do you mean?" he demanded in bewilderment. "What story?" "What gentleman?" Mr. Pounceby glanced sharply to his right, stopped dead, and remained as rigid as if he had just awoken from a nightmare. His mouth sagged open, his skin turned the color of chalk. "My God!" he exclaimed, and again slowly, almost in a whisper, "My God!" He wheeled round and peered up the dim perspective of the lane. Beside the signpost, which stood gauntly against the diadem of pale clouds, was a man, an indistinct but recognizable figure, swiping with a stick at the long grass. An hour later, the two of them were in the pub at Felday, and had related their experience to the barman. Mr. Pounceby was still considerably shaken. Outside, the rain was sousing every inch of ground, and mist had descended as if to hold unholy communion with the deep, cold lake among the pines. "Grindley," said the barman, and spelt it out. "Mr. Oliver Grindley. That's who it was. It was a mercy he'd gone when you went back." "Why?" "Because that story about him and the dog is true, every word. It turned him up pretty bad. He's never been the same man since. And if he knew that something of the sort had happened again today... We don't talk much about it in these parts. It was a Grindley, you know, that murdered James Coulter's wife, and had Coulter hanged for it on that spot where the signpost is now. That's another queer thing, the way Mr. Grindley is always up alone by that signpost. Seems to sort of fascinate him. You can't explain these things, though, and it's my belief that it's wisest not to think about 'em. But there's some would like to know, though they don't care to hang about Gibbet Lane and find out," said the barman slowly, "just what that dog of his saw, which sent him hell for leather back home, pretty near stark mad with fear." Mr. Pounceby, who was paler than usual, glanced at his own blurred reflection in the dark rain-slashed window. "I shouldn't," he said, and ordered two more double whiskies. Suffer the Little Children by Stephen King. Miss Sidley was her name, and teaching was her game. She was a small woman who had to reach on tiptoes to write on the highest level of the blackboard, which she was doing now. Behind her, none of the children giggled or whispered or munched on secret sweets held in cupped hands. They knew Miss Sidley too well. Miss Sidley knew instinctively who was chewing gum at the back of the room, who had a bean shooter in his pocket, who wanted to go to the bathroom to trade baseball cards rather than use the facilities. Like God, she seemed to know everything all at once. She was graying, and the brace she wore to support her failing back was lying clearly against her print dress. Small, constantly suffering, gimlet-eyed woman. But they feared her. Her tongue was a schoolyard legend. The eyes, when turned on a giggler or a whisperer, could turn the stoutest knees to water. Now, writing the day's list of spelling words on the slate, she reflected that the success of her long teaching career could be summed and checked and proven by this one everyday action. She could turn her back on her pupils in confidence. "Vacation," she said, pronouncing the word as she wrote it in a firm, no-nonsense script. "Edward, you will please use the word vacation in a sentence." "I went on a vacation to New York City," Edward piped. Then, as Miss Sidley had taught, he repeated the word carefully, "vacation." "Very good, Edward," she began the next word. She had her little tricks, of course. Success, she firmly believed, depended as much upon taking note of little things as it did upon the big ones. She applied the principle constantly in the classroom, and it never failed. "Jane," she said quietly. Jane, who had been furtively perusing her reader, looked up guiltily. "Close that book right now, please." The book shut. Jane looked pale, hating eyes at Miss Sidley's back. "And you will stay for 15 minutes after the final bell." Jane's lips trembled. "Yes, Miss Sidley." One of her little tricks was the careful use of her glasses. The whole class was reflected to her in their thick lenses, and she had always been thinly amused by their guilty, frightened faces when she caught them at their nasty little games. Now she saw a fantomish, distorted Robert in the first row wrinkle his nose. She did not speak. Robert would hang himself if given just a little more rope. "Tomorrow," she pronounced clearly. "Robert, will you please use the word tomorrow in a sentence?" Robert frowned over the problem. The classroom was hushed and sleepy in the late September sun. The electric clock over the door buzzed a rumor of 3 o'clock dismissal just a half hour away, and the only thing that kept young heads from drowsing over their spellers was the silent, ominous threat of Miss Sidley's back. "I am waiting, Robert." "Tomorrow a bad thing will happen," Robert said. The words were perfectly innocuous, but Miss Sidley, with the seventh sense that all strict disciplinarians have, could sense a double meaning. "Tomorrow," Robert finished. His hands were folded neatly on the desk, and he wrinkled his nose again. He also smiled a tiny side-of-the-mouth smile. Miss Sidley was suddenly, unaccountably sure Robert knew her little trick with the glasses. "Very well." She began to write the next word with no comment of commendation for Robert, letting her straight body speak its own message. She watched carefully with one eye. Soon Robert would stick out his tongue or make that disgusting finger gesture just to see if she really knew what he was doing. Then he would be punished. The reflection was small, ghostly, and distorted, and she had but the barest corner of her eye on the words she was writing. Robert changed. She caught just a corner of it, just a frightening glimpse of Robert's face changing into something different. She whirled around, face white, barely noticing the protesting stab of pain in her back. Robert looked at her blandly, questioningly. His hands were neatly folded. The first signs of an afternoon cowlick showed at the back of his head. He did not look frightened. "I have imagined it," she thought. "I was looking for something, and when there was nothing, I just made something up. However..." "Robert," she asked. She had meant to be authoritative, the unspoken demand for confession. It did not come out that way. "Yes, Miss Sidley?" His eyes were a very dark brown, like the mud at the bottom of a slow-running stream. "Nothing." She turned back to the board, and a little whisper ran through the class. "Be quiet," her voice snapped. She turned again and faced them. "Another sound, and we will all stay after school with Jane." She addressed the whole class, but looked particularly at Robert. He looked back with a childlike, "I didn't do it" innocence. She turned to the board and began to write, not looking out of the corners of her glasses. The last half hour dragged, and it seemed that Robert gave her a strange look on the way out. A look that said, "We have a secret, don't we?" It wouldn't get out of her mind. It seemed to be stuck like a tiny string of roast beef between two molars. A small thing, actually, but feeling as big as a cinder block. She sat down to her solitary dinner at 5 poached eggs on toast, still thinking about it. She knew she was getting older and accepted the knowledge calmly. She was not going to be one of those old ladies school teachers dragging, kicking, and screaming from their classrooms at the age of retirement. They reminded her of gamblers emotionally unable to leave the table while they were losing. But she was not losing. She had always been a winner. She looked down at her poached egg. Hadn't she? She thought of the well-scrubbed faces in her third-grade classroom and found Robert's face superimposed over them. She got up and switched on a light. Later, just before dropping off to sleep, Robert's face floated in front of her, smiling unpleasantly in the darkness behind her lids. The face began to change. But before she saw exactly what it was changing into, she dropped off to sleep. Miss Sidley spent an unrestful night, and the next day her temper was short. She waited, almost hoped, for a whisper, a giggler, or perhaps even a note passer. But the class was quiet, very quiet. They all stared at her unresponsively, and it seemed that she could feel the weight of their eyes on her like blind, crawling ants. "Now stop," she told herself sternly. She paused, controlling an urge to bite her lip. She was acting like a skittish girl just out of seminary. Again, the day seemed to drag, and she believed she was more relieved than her charges when the dismissal bell rang. The children lined up in orderly rows at the door, boys and girls by height, hands dutifully linked. "Dismissed," she said, and listened sourly as they shrieked down the hall and into the bright sunlight. What was it? It was bulbous. It shimmered and it changed, and it stared at me. Yes, stared and grinned. And it wasn't a child at all. It was old, and it was evil, and... "Miss Sidley?" Her head jerked up a little. "Oh," hiccuped involuntarily from her throat. It was Mr. Hanning. He smiled apologetically. "Didn't mean to disturb you." "Quite all right," she said, more curtly than she had intended. What had she been thinking? What was wrong with her? "Would you mind checking the paper towels in the girls' laboratory?" "Surely." She got up, placing her hands against the small of her back. Mr. Hanning looked at her sympathetically. Save it, she thought. The old maid is not amused, or even interested. She brushed by Mr. Hanning and started down the hall to the girls' laboratory. A capering group of small boys carrying scratched and pitted baseball equipment grew silent at the sight of her and leaked out the door, where their cries began again. Miss Sidley looked after them resentfully, reflecting that children had been different in her day. Not more polite. Children have never had time for that. And not exactly more respectful of their elders. It was a kind of hypocrisy that had never been there before. A smiling quietness around adults that had never been there before. A kind of quiet contempt that was upsetting and unnerving. As if they were hiding behind masks. She pushed the thought away and went into the laboratory. It was a small tiled room with frosted glass windows shaped like an L. The toilets were ranged along one bar, the sinks along both sides of the shorter bar. As she checked along the paper towel container, she caught a glimpse of her face in one of the mirrors and was startled into looking at it more closely. God! There was a look that hadn't been there 2 days before, a frightened watching look. With sudden shock, she realized that the tiny blurred reflection in her glasses, coupled with Robert's pale, respectful face, had gotten inside her and was festering. The door opened, she heard two girls come in, giggling secretly about something. She was about to turn the corner and walk out past them when she heard her own name. She turned back to the washbowls and began checking the towel holders again. "And then he?" Soft giggles. "She knows, but..." More giggles, soft and sticky as melting soap. "Miss Sidley is..." "Stop it! Stop that noise!" By moving slightly, she could see their shadows, made fuzzy and ill-defined by the diffused light filtering through the frosted windows, holding onto each other with girlish glee. Another thought crawled up out of her mind. They knew she was there. Yes, they did, the little bitches. They knew. She would shake them until their teeth rattled and their giggles turned to wails, and she would make them admit that they knew. They knew they... The shadows changed. They seemed to elongate, to flow like dripping tallow, taking on strange hunch shapes that made Miss Sidley cringe back against the porcelain washstands, her heart swelling in her chest. But they went on giggling. The voices changed, no longer girlish, now sexless and soulless and quite, quite evil. A slow, turgid smile of mindless humor that flowed around the corner to her like river mud. She stared at the hunched shadows and suddenly screamed at them. The scream went on and on, swelling in her head until it attained a pitch of lunacy, and then she fainted. The giggling, like the laughter of demons, followed her down into darkness. She could not, of course, tell them the truth. Miss Sidley knew this even as she opened her eyes and looked up at the anxious face of Mr. Hanning and Mrs. Croson. Mrs. Croson was holding a bottle of sharp-smelling stuff under her nose. Mr. Hanning turned around and told the two little girls, who were looking curiously at Miss Sidley, to go on home now, please. They both smiled at her, slow. We have a secret smiles, and went out. Very well. She could keep their secret for a while. She would not have people thinking her insane. She would not have them thinking that the first feelers of senility had touched her early. She would play their game. Until she could expose their nastiness and rip it out by the roots. "I'm afraid I slipped," she said calmly, sitting up and ignoring the excruciating pain in her back. "A patch of wetness." "This is awful," Mr. Hanning said. "Terrible. Are you..." "Did the fall hurt your back, Emily?" Mrs. Croson interrupted. Mr. Hanning looked at her gratefully. Miss Sidley got up, her spine screaming in her body. "No," she said. "In fact, something seems to have snapped back into place. It actually feels better." "We can send for a..." Mr. Hanning began. No physician necessary. I'll just go on home, Miss Sidley smiled at him coolly. I will get your taxi. I always take the bus, Miss Sidley said. She walked out. Mr. Hanning sighed and looked at Mrs. Croson. She does seem more like herself. The next day, Miss Sidley kept Robert after school. He did nothing, so she simply accused him falsely. She felt no qualms. He was a monster, not a little boy, and she would make him admit it. Her back was in agony. She realized Robert knew. He expected that would help him, but it wouldn't. That was another of her little advantages. Her back had been a constant pain to her for the last 12 years, and there had been times when it had been this bad, well, almost as bad as this. She closed the door, shutting the two of them in. For a moment, she stood still, training her gaze on Robert. She waited for him to drop his eyes. He didn't. He gazed back at her, and presently a little smile began to play around the corners of his mouth. "Why are you smiling, Robert?" she asked softly. "I don't know," Robert went on smiling. "Tell me, please, Robert." Robert said nothing. He went on smiling. The outside sound of children at play were far off, distant, dreamy. Only the hypnotic buzz of the wall clock was real. "There's quite a few of us," Robert said suddenly, as if he were commenting on the weather. It was Miss Sidley's turn to be silent. 11, right here in this school," Robert went on smiling his small smile. "Quite evil," she thought, amazed. "Very incredibly evil." "Please don't lie," she said clearly. "Lies only make things worse." Robert's smile grew wider, became vulpine. "Do you want to see me change, Miss Sidley?" he asked. "Would you like to see it right out?" Miss Sidley felt a nameless chill. "Go away," she said curtly, "and bring your mother and father to school with you tomorrow. We'll get this business straightened out." There, on solid ground again, she waited for his face to crumble, waited for the tears and the pleas to relent. Robert's smile grew wider. He showed his teeth. "It will be just like show and tell, won't it, Miss Sidley?" Robert, the other Robert, he liked show and tell. "He's still hiding way, way down in my head." The smile curled at the corners of his mouth like charring paper. "Sometimes he runs around. It itches. He wants me to let him out." "Go away," Miss Sidley said numbly. The buzzing of the clock seemed very loud. Robert changed. His face suddenly ran together like the melting wax, the eyes flattening and spreading like knife-struck egg yolks, nose widening and yawning, mouth disappearing, the head elongated, and the hair was suddenly not hair, but straggling, twitching growths. Robert began to chuckle. The slow, cavernous sound came from what had been his nose, but the nose was eating into the lower half of his face, nostrils meeting, emerging into a central blackness like a huge, shouting mouth. Robert got up, still chuckling, and behind it all she could see the last shattered remains of the other Robert, howling in maniac terror, screeching to be let out. She ran. She fled screaming down the corridor, and the few late leaving pupils turned to look at her with large and uncomprehending eyes. Mr. Hanning jerked open his door and looked out just as Miss Sidley plunged through the wide glass front doors, a wild, waving scarecrow silhouetted against the bright September sky. He ran after her, Adam's apple bobbing convulsively. "Miss Sidley! Miss Sidley!" Robert came out of the classroom and watched curiously. Miss Sidley neither heard nor saw. She clattered down the walk and across the sidewalk and into the streets with her screams trailing behind her like banners. There was a huge blatting horn, and then the bus was looming over her, the bus driver's face a plaster mask of fear. Air brakes whined and hissed like dragons in flight. Miss Sidley fell, and the huge wheels shuddered to a smoking stop just 8 inches from her frail, brace-armored body. She lay shuddering on the pavement, hearing the crowd gather around her. She turned over and the children were staring down at her. They were ringed in a tight little circle like mourners around an open grave. And at the head of the grave was Robert, his little face sober and solemn, ready to read the death rites and shovel the first spade of dirt over her face. From far away, the bus driver's shaken babble. "Crazy or something? My God, Another half a foot? Miss Sidley stared numbly at the children. Their shadows covered her and blocked out the sun. Their faces were impassive. Some of them were smiling little secret smiles. And Miss Sidley knew that soon she would begin to scream again. Then Mr. Hanning broke their tight noose and shooed them away. Miss Sidley began to sob weakly. She did not go back to her third grade for a month. She told Mr. Hanning calmly that she had not been feeling herself, and Mr. Hanning suggested that she go to a reputable doctor and discuss the matter with him. Miss Sidley agreed that this was the only sensible and rational course. She also said that if the school board wished her resignation, she would tender it immediately, although it would hurt her very much. Mr. Hanning looked uncomfortable, said he doubted if that would be necessary. The upshot of the matter was that Miss Sidley went back to her class in late October, once again ready to play the game, and now knowing how to play it. For the first week, she let things go on as ever. It seemed the whole class now regarded her with hostile, shell-lit eyes. Robert smiled distantly at her from his first row seat, and she did not have the courage to take him to task. Once, while on playground duty, Robert walked over to her holding a dodgem ball, smiling. "There's more of us now," he said. "Lots, lots more." A girl in the jungle gym looked across the playground at them and smiled, as if she had heard. Miss Sidley smiled serenely, refusing to remember the face changing, mutating. "Why, Robert, whatever do you mean?" But Robert only continued smiling and went back to his game. Miss Sidley knew the time had come. She brought the gun to school in her handbag. It had been her brother's Jim's. He had taken it from a dead German shortly after the Battle of the Bulge. Jim had been gone 10 years now. She had not opened the box that held the gun in more years than that, but when she did, it was still there, gleaming dully. The 4 clips of shells were still in the box, too, and she loaded carefully, the way Robert had showed her once. She smiled pleasantly at her class, at Robert in particular. Robert smiled back, and she could see the murky alienness swimming just below his skin, muddy, full of filth. She never cared, wondering just what was impersonating Robert, but she wished she knew if the real Robert was still inside. She did not wish to be a murderess. She decided that the real Robert must have died or gone insane, living inside the dirty, crawling thing that had chuckled at her in the classroom and sent her screaming into the street. So even if he was still alive, putting him out of his misery would be a mercy. "Today we're going to have a test," Miss Sidley said. The class did not groan or shift apprehensively. They merely looked at her. She could feel their eyes, like weights, heavy, smothering. "It's a very special test. I will call you down to the mimeographing room one by one and give you your test. Then you may have a candy and go home for the day. Won't that be nice?" They smiled empty smiles and said nothing. "Robert, will you come first?" Robert got up, smiling his little smile. He wrinkled his nose quite openly at her. "Yes, Miss Sidley." Miss Sidley took her bag, and they went down the empty, echoing corridor together, past the sleepy buzz of reciting classes coming from behind closed doors. The mimeograph room was at the far end of the hall, past the laboratories. It had been soundproofed 2 years ago. The big machine was very old and very noisy. Miss Sidley closed the door behind them and locked it. "No one can hear you," she said calmly. She took the gun from her bag. "You or the gun." Robert smiled innocently. "There are lots of us, though. Lots more than here." He put one small, scrubbed hand on the paper tray of the mimeograph machine. "Would you like to see me change, Miss Sidley?" Before she could speak, the change began. Robert's face began to melt and shimmer into the grotesqueness beneath, and Miss Sidley shot him once in the head. He fell back against the paper-lined shelves and slid down to the floor, a little dead boy with a round black hole above the right eye. He looked very pathetic. Miss Sidley stood over him, breathing hard. Her scrawny cheeks were livid. The huddled figure didn't move. It was human. It was Robert. "No. It was all in your mind, Emily, all in your mind. No. No, no, no." She went back up to the room and began to lead them down one by one. She killed 12 of them, and would have killed them all, if Mrs. Croson hadn't come down for a package of composition paper. Mrs. Croson's eyes got very big. One hand crept up and clutched her mouth. She began to scream, and she was still screaming when Miss Sidley reached her and put a hand on her shoulder. "It had to be done, Margaret," she said sadly to the screaming Mrs. Croson. "It's terrible. It had to. They are all monsters. I found out." Mrs. Croson stared at the gay-clothed little body scattered around the mimeograph and continued to scream. The little girl whose hand Miss Sidley was holding began to cry steadily and monotonously. "Change," Miss Sidley said. "Change for Mrs. Croson. Show her it had to be done." The girl continued to weep uncomprehendingly. "Damn you, change!" Miss Sidley screamed. "Dirty little bitch. Dirty, crawling, filthy, unnatural bitch. Change! God damn you, change!" She raised the gun. The little girl cringed. And then Miss Croson was on her like a cat. And Miss Sidley's back gave way. No trial. The paper screamed for a trial. Bereaved parents swore hysterical oaths against Miss Sidley. And the city sat back on its haunches in numb shock. 12 children. The state legislature called for more stringent teacher examination tests. Summer Street School closed for a week of mourning, and Miss Sidney went quietly to an antiseptic madhouse in the next state. She was put in deep analysis, given the most modern drugs, introduced into daily work therapy sessions. A year later, under strictly controlled conditions, Miss Sidley was put in an experimental encounter therapy situation. Buddy Jenkins was his name. Psychiatry was his game. He sat behind a one-way glass with a clipboard looking into a room which had been outfitted as a nursery. On the far wall, the cow was jumping over the moon and the mouse was halfway up the clock. Miss Sidley sat in her wheelchair with a storybook, surrounded by a group of soft, trusting, totally mindless, retarded children. They smiled at her and drooled and touched her with small wet fingers, while attendants at the next window watched for the first sign of an aggressive move. For a time, Buddy thought she responded well. She read aloud, stroked the girl's head, picked up a small boy when he fell over a toy block. Then she seemed to see something which disturbed her. A frown creased her brow, and she looked away from the children. "Take me away, please," Miss Sidley said softly and tonelessly, to no one in particular. And so they took her away. Buddy Jenkins watched the children watch her go, their eyes wide and empty, but somehow deep. One smiled, and another put its fingers in his mouth slyly. Two little girls clutched each other and giggled. That night, Miss Sidley cut her throat with a bit of broken mirror glass, and Buddy Jenkins began to watch the children.